I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and it's glad to welcome you to Tuesday evenings. I want to make a couple of announcements first. I want to talk a little bit about our Sunday tours. This past Sunday, Dr. Malcolm Warner of the Kimball did a wonderful job touring aspects of Vernon Fisher Kmart conceptualism. I hope you were here for that. If not, or if you want to review it, there are audio podcasts on the Modern's website of his and all of those that have preceded. So feel free to check that out. In fact, including the one that was by Vernon Fisher himself. They've all been really good. It's kind of interesting how people have had different perspectives. We, of course, continue this coming Sunday with the artist Micah Yarbrough, followed on November 21st with the art historian and one of the exhibition catalog authors, and if you were here for the last Tuesday evening, you're familiar with her insights. Dr. Frances Colpitt will again go through the Vernon Fisher exhibition, and then on November 28th, the artist Annette Lawrence. Each of these people have, of course, a unique, and in fact, with each of these guys, a personal perspective on the exhibition. These tours continue through December and on into 2011. Some will focus on the special exhibition, others on the collection and the architecture. They're always at 1 p.m., and they're free with the cost of admission, making it always free, of course, for members, and then free on the first Sunday for everyone, since there is no admission charge on the first Sunday of each month. That is the only program advertisement for tonight, but it's really hard for me to stop there because there is so much more. So for your sake and for my compulsion to make sure that you're informed, I strongly encourage you to visit the Modern's website where that is all listed and all the details are given. Let's see. Of course, tonight you're here for Tuesday Evenings at the Modern, which is a weekly lecture series that occurs each fall and then again winter, spring. Next week was supposed to be the last lecture for the fall 2010 season, but due to scheduling conflicts, artist Uta Bart had to cancel. However, I'm happy to report that Uta has been rescheduled and will open the winter, spring 2011 season on February 8th. So I invite you to all mark your calendars for that. That makes tonight's lecture our fall finale, and as it turns out, a wonderful way to close what I think has been an extraordinary season, because artist Spencer Finch, whose work came to my attention as some of the most compelling and beautiful work in Daniel Birnbaum's formidable exhibition, Making Worlds, the 53rd Venice Biennale, is here tonight for the last Tuesday evening of the season from his home and studio in Brooklyn. Some of you may recall Spencer's work or know Spencer's work from Art Pace in San Antonio, where he was an artist in residence in 2003. Having studied at Doshisha University in Kyoto, Japan, and with a BA in comparative literature from Hamilton College, Spencer has shown extensively since receiving his MFA in sculpture from RISD in 1989. And for sake of time, I'm just going to cite exhibitions within the past 2 years. But I wanted to just bring to your attention that Spencer has had solo exhibitions in the UK, Berlin, France, Norway, Washington, D.C., New York, Chicago, and Australia, including Spencer Finch, My Business with the Cloud, that opened this past September and closes on January 23rd, if anybody's headed that way, at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in D.C. And again, that is just in the last 2 years. Most of it this year, in fact. Recent group exhibitions include The Decor this past summer at Hayward Gallery in London, Haunted Contemporary Photography Video Performance this year at the Guggenheim in New York, and as mentioned, the last Venice Biennale. And then there is a long list of commissions, public projects, and performances that includes no less than 4 from this year. So I'm trying to make a point. And what amazes me about such prolificacy is what I perceive to be the nature of this work. In her essay for the 2007 solo exhibition, What Time Is It on the Sun at Mass MoCA, which I think we have a few catalogs from in the bookstore if you're interested, Susan Cross describes Spencer's dutiful process of carefully recording the invisible world by simultaneously striving to understand what might lie beyond it. Whether he is relying on his own powers of observation or using the color meter, which is something I'm going to let Spencer explain to you, the artist employs a scientific method to achieve poetic ends. Contrary to what one might expect, Finch's efforts toward accuracy, the precise measurements he takes under different conditions and at different times of day, resist in the end a definitive result or single empirical truth about his subject. And then, of course, there are also all of his literary and theoretical references, as is the case with tonight's title for tonight's presentation, tied to what I see as being this really beautiful, while sometimes intriguingly common work, all of which would seem to require, to my mind, a great deal of insight, broad knowledge, extensive research, and numerous man hours, making me a little surprised yet extremely grateful that there was time to be here. So with that in mind, will you please join me in welcoming Spencer Finch as he presents Remarks in Color.
Thank you, Terry, for that kind introduction. It's really nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me and for organizing it. I also like to thank Michael for his organization of this. It's nice when things go smoothly, so far at least. I always like to know what I'm getting into before one of these things, so I'll tell you I have exactly 92 slides, but which sounds like a lot, and I should have. I was trying to, as I was organizing it, there were a lot of different threads that I was trying to bring together. One, of course, was color, which is something that's been interesting to me and important to me since for about 20 years, since I really started making the work that's my own. But I also wanted to include some work that that deals with projects I've done in Texas or in the American West, which is something else that's really the idea of landscape, and particularly the landscape of the American West, is something that's been really interesting to me over the course of many years. So everything's organized sort of chronologically, which is really boring, I know, but once or twice I've tried to like mix it up, and it gets really, really sort of schizophrenic, and it's not a pretty sight. One other caveat is this all makes sense to me, obviously, as all of you artists in the audience know, your work usually makes sense to yourself, although not always. I realize that it's not totally clear always. So feel free to interrupt with questions if something's not clear. And also, I realize that I sometimes forget the most sort of basic things, like what the material is, or how big it is, or what the subject is. So feel free to chime in if something's not clear. This first work is a drawing on with ink on mutsu paper. And when I got out of graduate school in 1989, I sort of went back to sort of a clean slate and really tried to think. Whether I wanted to go on with being an artist, and then the sort of second step of that, what does it mean? And sort of asking elemental, pretty elemental questions. I was reading a lot of, I'd been mainlining French theory during graduate school, and I realized that I could go back to the original sources of that, which were largely Freud and Wittgenstein, which sounds sort of pretentious, but is really not so difficult to read compared to that other stuff. So that was sort of what I was reading, and a lot of Susan Sontag also, who was very important in terms of her theories of representation, which of course is connected to Roland Barthes, and also Samuel Beckett, who I've had a sort of obsession with on and off for 20 years. So anyway, I decided to sort of start from scratch and start making pictures of what I saw looking at the world with my eyes closed. And so this is a picture of, I went out to the Grand Canyon. This is a picture of the Grand Canyon from Inspiration Point with my eyes closed. So I went out with ink and Mutsu paper, camped out there, set up, and just did this series of works. It's unfortunately not a very good image. It's hard to photograph. These are so it's morning, noon, afternoon, late afternoon. I developed a sort of obsession with Claude Monet in graduate school. It was a sort of classic Stockholm syndrome where I was really critical of him, and so one of my friends dared me to make a copy of a Monet painting if it's so like saccharine and easy. And so I went to the RISD Museum where you're allowed to actually work with oil paint and do it. And I was sort of a preposterous thing, but I made a few copies of a fantastic 1872 painting, The Basin at Argenteuil, and realized how incredibly difficult it was and how complex it was and how interesting it was, and you know, of course, fell in love with my intended victim. And became interested especially in the serial work from the 1890s, which I saw as a response to photography. And a lot of this work, a lot of the early work, at least from more than 10 years ago, was a real response to photography. And this idea of this of a single moment, sort of meaningless moment that's sort of frozen into some sort of historical truth. And I was interested in the seriality of work and also the subjectivity of trying to find a sort of subjectivity in an image of my own that could not be photographed. Here's this is from 1994. It's a sort of strange. It's a sighting device for locating the precise point in the sky where the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded. So I did all the math, got the azimuth exactly correct, and went down to, I got permission from NASA to set up right next to the camera that had recorded the explosion of the Challenger, and then line this up. So there's a compass on the stand, and the viewing angle was precise so that when my eye was down at the end of the rod and looked up through the square, that square equaled exactly 1 square kilometer of the sky and would fill the entire explosion of the shuttle. And the end result was just, I mixed the paint until it matched the color of the sky. This is a funny project from about the same time, which I think is really, probably of anything I've done, is really sort of Beckett-inspired. And it's called Blue Wave, and it's this idea of the sort of impossibility of really representing anything or communicating anything. And I think I was, I don't know, I was feeling, you know, misunderstood. And this was my result. There's a great line from Beckett in his book about Proust, where he says, I call it his "I Have a Dream" speech, and where he says, "I have a dream unresentful of its insuperable indigence and too proud for the farce of giving and receiving." So this was sort of some sort of homage to that, the sort of impossibility of trying to convey something through art. And so anyway, what I did, I had my brainwave recorded while looking at the blue wave from Hawaii 5-0. I'm going to use this great laser pointer. So there's the blue wave from the beginning of Hawaii 5-0, which if you missed it in the first time in the 70s, it's coming back, so you'll be able to see. Although I'm not sure if it's such a beautiful wave. So 1 second of that was recorded with this biofeedback software onto that classic Mac, which was then transferred to a video, which was then sent to this little transmitter and transmitted to outer space to the bluest star in the night sky, which is, if you know your constellations, the left boot of Regal, of Orion, called Regal, is the bluest star in the night sky. And it's 960 light years away, and so this was about 15 years ago, so it should get there in 944 years. And one of my favorite people in the world is this guy, Bill Olson, who designed this antenna for me. It's a microwave antenna, and I was transmitting in violation of FCC regulations. It has to be microwave in order to penetrate the ionosphere so it can actually get out there and go to outer space so that it will get to Regal in 944 years. And he has two great jobs. He lives in Maine. He's an antenna designer and builder and a square dance caller. Those are his two jobs, really. And when I have shows in New York, sometimes he comes down because he's on the sort of circuit. And if he likes something, he doesn't say anything, he just like starts stamping his foot. So it's really, he's a fantastic art viewer. And is not at all involved in the art world, which is great. So I like to boast that this is the biggest sculpture in the world, bigger even than that Richard Serra out front, because it's only 2.5 centimeters high, but it's 186,000 miles long. Jumbo. And invisible.
Where is it now?
It's in outer space. I mean, the signal is in outer space. This is—I really think of this as sort of the equipment is sort of—I mean, it's a weird thing. It's sort of the record of it, and so it has been. The orange chair, it was sold. Someone bought this stuff, the junk of it. But that orange chair is my studio chair, which I wouldn't give up, and it's still—it's even more disgusting now. Okay, let's see. This is a fresco that I did in 1995. I was really interested in making a sort of a blank image, and I went to Sigmund Freud's house in Vienna and recorded the light above the couch where the analysands were psychoanalyzed, and did a series of frescoes based on what that view was at different times of day. There you can see the three of them, morning, noon, afternoon. It was really fun to learn how to do fresco. It took a while, but a few of them just slid right off. The top layer would slide right off. But it was a fun thing to learn, which, of course, I haven't used since, except like for concrete purposes. And the shape is based on studies John Ruskin did in the 19th century, trying to find the closest geometric equivalent to the human field of vision. So the idea was to sort of imbue the form with this idea of seeing and of this idea of projecting whatever it is that someone projects. Here's a piece. I did a couple pieces in Dealey Plaza in the 90s. I was really interested in the Warren Commission report as a sort of historical document because of how people, how there's so many different stories that are told about seeing something, how this sort of subjectivity of a historical event, or the objectivity of the historical event is dependent on the subjectivity of the witnesses. And so I was really interested in seeing what people saw or didn't see. So I did these drawings of Dealey Plaza viewed from different locations through my blind spots. So it's a little hard to explain, but you know, we have blind spots in the back in each eye, which is where the optic nerve connects to the retina and back. And so that shape on the shape on the left is the blind spot of my right eye, and the shape on the left is the blind spot of on the right is the blind spot of my left eye. And so when I was looking at the hatch mark, I had this thing set up on an easel. People were like giving me wide berth. I looked kind of like Well, I was, I guess, one of the crazies at Dealey Plaza. So I set, anyway, I set it up so that when I was focused with my right eye on the crosshatch and was looking through that hole, that perfectly aligned with my blind spot. So even though I was seeing something, I wasn't really seeing anything, because what happens is your eye moves a little bit and it your brain fills in what it thinks is there, which is why when we're looking, we don't see these actual holes in our vision. I mean, also with two eyes, one eye fills in for the other, but the slight movement fills it in. So this was looking at Dealey Plaza through my blind spot. So I wasn't actually seeing anything, but I did in my brain I saw something because the brain was filling it in. And so and then I just worked in pastel there quickly to make those drawings. Another JFK piece, this is called Trying to Remember the Color of Jackie Kennedy's Pillbox Hat. There's 100 pink drawings, each one different, each one very specific. It was fun to make, and it's sort of fun that people, when it's exhibited, people really see, they pick their favorites. It's always nice to have that happen. Well, what's interesting is Jackie's hat is no one knows where it is, because it's supposed to be in the archive, but it's not there. So the hat is actually has disappeared. The color itself is called Schiaparelli pink, based on the designer. I didn't know at the time, but it's called Schiaparelli pink. I don't think it's that one. This is a photographic piece that I did around 95, I think, for the first time. It's called Self-Portrait as Crazy Horse, and cyanotype painted onto the wall, and then I just stood in front of it from dawn till dusk, from 7 in the morning till 7 at night, I think it was, in the middle of the year. And you can see a spitting image of me right there. And what it is it's a negative. So it's a negative of the my shadow. And it's the title comes from this kind of amazing fact that Crazy Horse. I mean, there's a common feeling among Plains Indians that they didn't want to be photographed, and they felt that the camera. I mean, I guess the translation is stole one's soul. But there's a great line from Crazy Horse where he says, "Why would you wish to shorten my life by taking from me my shadow?" This idea of, I mean, it's almost Faustian, this idea of the shadow, of your shadow being taken. And I love this idea of not wanting to be named that way, and to have keep this sort of, to have a self-portrait that's sort of fugitive. And a cyanotype's really easy to use. So it's also a record of the light in the room, obviously, because it's on the wall. And it's just a matter of painting it on, and because with cyanotype, you just pour water on it, and that serves as the developer, the fix, and the wash. It's a one-step process. So I just set up a gutter at the bottom and pour water on it, and it records the light. I decided to act on my obsession with Monet, and in 96, I think this was, I went to Rouen, where he did the famous cathedral series of paintings, which I had been obsessed with. I think there are 37 of them, done in different light conditions, different weather conditions. And so I took time off work and went to Paris, took the train to Normandy, had all my paper watercolors, was ready to go. I had 5 days there to work, and I arrived, the whole cathedral was covered in scaffolding and I couldn't see anything. So, being desperate and resourceful, I stayed in my hotel room the whole time and recorded the changing light in the hotel room. So this is morning, this is noon, this is afternoon, I believe. And you can see a detail. So it's each of the colors. It's sort of a inversion of impressionism in a way, in that when you step back, you get this sort of, you get a sense of all the colors and the sort of changing colors. And when you get up close, you realize it's actually a picture. It's actually a picture of a room. There's a bedspread, which looks like I misspelled it. pillow and shadow, the molding, and so all of these colors. And it's sort of a map of all the colors in the motel room. This is a series I did in 96, 97, I think, of their encaustic wax paintings on panel of the view of what Icarus saw when he fell into the sea. So the shape is again based on Ruskin, and it's a series. So this is the third one, I think. So it sort of starts with him like this. So if you imagine his field of vision, he sort of goes down, and the sea comes in, and then he starts falling this way, and then he twists over, and then it's like, and then he's turning this way, turning all the way around, and then finally, in the last one, it's splash. And what I wasn't expecting, one great thing about this project was that it smelled of beeswax. So in the gallery, when it was first shown, there was this incredible smell of beeswax. So it was a real sort of extra sensory or multi-sensory experience. These were also, I think, the first works I ever sold, which were sold to the insurance company because they were damaged in an exhibition and they were cut in half by with chainsaws and had to, because the insurance company insisted. And they sent me a check. It was fantastic. This is the first sort of straight photographic piece I think I ever did. I was interested in the description. I don't remember who said it. Describing Ache's photographs of Paris as being like an alibi. You know, those photographs where there's no one there. And this is 48 views of Loch Ness. And so I was thinking about this as the inverse. I mean, photography is like used as evidence always. And I don't know what really was meant by an alibi, but I really love that description. It's almost the opposite of evidence, right? I mean, it's almost like proving a negative. You know, I wasn't there. And so this is trying to prove a negative to prove that the Loch Ness Monster doesn't exist. Although I was obsessed with trying to find him and didn't want to look away. So I was just shooting roll after roll after roll of film. And of course it sort of looks like it might be, you know, in a few places. It's like, so, you know, a little something there or what's going on here. But this idea of photography being used to as an alibi to sort of prove a negative was somehow interesting to me. The work that I look back on that I'm happiest with is work that's just done when I'm bored in the studio, and this is one of those things. My studio was and still is by the Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn, which was I think after the Cuyahoga River, which is the one that caught on fire, the second most polluted waterway in the country. And it smelled. I mean, it still smells. It's not nearly as bad. It smells in the summer. And so this was just an attempt to make a drawing of the smell of the canal. And trying to use color to represent smell. So the way I sort of figured it is this is the sort of this is time is this way, and this is just quality of smell this way. If you imagine it being a graph, so a whiff goes like that. So the sort of this is the beginning of the smell, and this is the end, and this is, you know, if you're like in wine, what is that, like the top note or the high note or something? So that's the end of it. See, this one's more, I think this, it has a sort of accurate ending, so that might be the most accurate one. Here's another sort of bored in the studio piece. This is a poke in the eye where I do this sometimes. I just poke myself in the eye and these shapes come up. And I was trying to get around the photograph. I was thinking, well, what can I do? What can I make, you know, that the damn camera can't take a picture of? And so this is I figure, well, if it's actually not a visual phenomenon, not an optical phenomenon, or not a retinal phenomenon, I guess, but an optical phenomenon, then that's what this is. It's an eye poke. So this is actually that, I can tell it's the other eye. So yeah, this is the right eye from the outside edge. So you can do that at home too. This is called Study for a Groovy Unnameable Color, trying to figure out where yellow becomes green. This is my Newton piece, and it's called Composition in Red and Green, and it's an apple dropper that has there's a chute, and it drops an apple onto that AstroTurf carpet every 5 minutes, and it creates a new composition every day. And then the apples go up. Well, the apples get sort of inspected for rottenness, and then put back up there, and it does it again. This, however, was not a random composition. I composed those for the photograph. This is I've done a bunch of these. They're molecular light pieces. They're based on color, usually, though not always anymore. They started out as color pieces. So this is a picture, a sculpture of the color of the sky over Los Alamos, New Mexico, where the atom bomb was invented. And so it's the atomic models for three pigments. So this is that titanium white, TiO2. So the big bulb is titanium, which has a heavier atomic weight. And those two are oxygens. This is cobalt blue, COAL2O3. And in here is a complex ultramarine violet molecule. So what I did is I mixed pigment at the site, matched the exact color of the sky over the National Laboratory there, and then worked backwards where I figured out the percentage of weight of each of those pigments, and then from the actual mass of them, worked back and figured out the molecular weight and then the proportions of each of the molecules. So that's what that is. There's a detail. And I know incandescent lights are going the way of the horse and buggy, but I love them. That's another blind spot piece. That was, this is sort of like I heart my blind spots. You know, I just cut out the shapes and put rhinestones all over them. We all have a couple rhinestone pieces in us, I think. This is a piece from 2002. I kept a dream diary of colors from my dreams. This was another attempt of trying to get colors that were my own, that weren't from the world or weren't sort of corrupted by my system of perception. And so I kept a dream diary for about 2 years of colors from my dreams, and then made drawings using ink and the form of Rorschach blots for each of the colors. There's a detail. A ham in a Mercedes limousine. I had lots of limousine dreams. There's Bob Dylan, the vest Bob Dylan was wearing standing on top of a skyscraper. I was actually in psychotherapy at the time. It was sort of funny, but my shrink was not, I was interested in the color. She wanted a narrative to sort of help me, and I was not really as interested in the narrative as I was of the color. But it weirdly allowed some things, like sometimes a ham is not just a ham. This is the first fluorescent light piece I did, and I wanted for a long time to do something at the site of ancient Troy, and I don't know exactly why, but I just wanted to, I had loved the Iliad since I was a kid and just really wanted to see what all those people saw. And so I had worked on various bad ideas that were mostly, I think, came from Auden's great poem about Troy called The Shield of Achilles. So I had all of these bad pieces, and I never really got anywhere. And then I thought, well, what hasn't changed? The one thing that hasn't changed at the site of ancient Troy, because there were, I think, six Troys built over the site of Helen's Troy, the light hasn't changed. So I traveled to Troy, which is in present-day Turkey, and measured the light at dawn, and then recreated it using these high-end fluorescents that have really good color resolution and match the color of the light at dawn. So it was called Eos, which is the Greek word for dawn. And then I also did prism studies of the light at different times of day. As a detail. Here's a piece I did at Art Pace. This is a sunset, a Texas sunset, and I didn't really like it at first. I thought it kind of looked like an exploding ice cream truck, because the idea is to recreate the light. So you're really not supposed to be looking at this wall, but you're supposed to be looking at the facing wall, which is where the light is projected and recreates precisely the color of the light of the sunset. There's a detail, and this I show because this is one of those photographs that look better than the work actually does. There's this great photographer in San Antonio named Anselm Seal, who figured out how to do a triple exposure to get this right. And he just did a fantastic job and made it look so incredibly juicy. So the lesson, and this is when people want to reproduce images, this is often the first one they pick. So the lesson to learn is, it's not the work you make, it's how well it's photographed. No, I don't know what the... get good photographs. This is also a piece I did in Art Pace. It's called Paris, Texas, the title taken from the Wim Wenders film. And what it does, it was so hot. I was there in June and July. It was just so hot. And there's that yellow light of Texas in the summer that's so intense. And in the previous winter, I had been in Paris, France, and had measured the light there. And so what I decided to do was use stained glass to shift the light outside this summer hot Texas light to the cool light of Paris in the winter. And so that's what all these colors do. So all it was accurate for about 3 hours in the afternoon when it was sunny out. It shifted the light so that the summer in Texas became winter in Paris. And if anyone in Texas has two garage doors, let me know, because this is just sitting in storage. I'm trying to get rid of it. And it can only be in Texas, of course. Paris, you know. Paris, New York doesn't sound so good. This is a photograph. It's just seven photographs taken at 6 minute intervals. At 6 minute intervals of, oh no, 7 minute intervals, I think, of a window, looking out a window at a house in Vermont. And it's this moment when the window becomes a mirror because the light is going down. And so slowly, at first the window is transparent, and by the end the window is totally opaque because the light inside is brighter than the light outside. This idea I ripped off from the Japanese novelist Yasunori Kawabata, which he has a description of this in the novel Snow Country, where the protagonist is riding in the train, comes out of the tunnel, it's dusk, and all of a sudden this eyeball floats up in the window of the train, and he sort of is shocked and realizes it's a woman sitting diagonally across from him. This is a really sort of complicated piece. I came across this information in Vladimir Nabokov, the novelist, had what he called colored hearing. He associates a color with each with the sound of each letter in the alphabet, and so I thought that was amazing. You know, he just linked color with sound. So I mixed all the colors, didn't know what to do with it. Went back a few years later and created this mural based on transliterating Werner Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which I don't fully understand, but basically it says that when you observe something on the subatomic level, not on the physical level, but on a subatomic level, when you observe something, you change it, which I think is such a beautiful idea. and to especially to think of it metaphorically as on the sort of physical level of everyday reality. When you see something, when you look at something, you change it. It's an idea that I really love. So, and it somehow made sense with Nabokov's alphabet. So it's about 12,000 characters in the transliteration, and so that whole text got turned into this mural. So, for example, this color is B, that color is C. Oh, no, that's not C, that's C, that's M, pink flannel. This is F, brown shoelaces is K. So he had very clear descriptions. That is E, O. So for every letter in that original text, there is one drop of that color in the mural. This is a this is a piece I did in 95. In 2005. I'm sorry. It all blends together. This was it's called Passing Cloud for Emily Dickinson, and it is the or Sunlight in an Empty Room is the whole long title. And what it is it recreates the experience of a passing cloud that I measured in Emily Dickinson's backyard. So when you're standing in front of that bank of fluorescence, which is three different colors of fluorescence, it recreates the color of the sunlight that I measured in her backyard. And as you walk around the cloud, it recreates the experience of a passing cloud. Oops. Here's a piece I did in Miami that is balloons that are exactly match the color of the sky over Coney Island. So I realized that if you put a balloon of one color in a balloon of another color and blow it up, you can match almost any color. So I matched the color of the sky over Coney Island, figured out what the right to get the tone right. I blew it up to exactly 10 1/4 inches, and I was able to match the sky, the color of the sky. There it is. This is I made a lot of boring work in my day, and this is definitely top 10. This is two attempts at molecular orbital theory. I did a whole show about Prussian blue in 2004. That was the 200th anniversary of the invention of Prussian blue. And I was in Prussia. It was a show in Berlin. So I thought, oh, what a great opportunity to do a show about Prussia. Prussian blue. What was I thinking? And there are 11 sort of physical causes of color, and Prussian blue is caused by molecular orbital theory. So what I did is one of these rooms, the room on the left, has white light. And the walls are painted blue with Prussian blue paint. The room on the right has white walls, and the lights, the fluorescents, are filtered with Prussian blue to change the color of the light. So they look identical. It's hard to tell in this image, but they look identical until people walk into them, and then they walk into the one on the left, and they look sort of regular, and they walk into the one on the right, and they're all sort of blue and strange looking. But I'm so proud that I talked someone into making these two rooms for me. These are a series of darkness drawings I did in the cave in Lascaux, the famous Paleolithic cave, in different light conditions. It took a long time to get permission, and they were a little surprised that I wanted to be there in the dark, but that's those. Getting a little bit of a lag here. This is a light box. It's a piece based on a sort of trip to Walt Whitman's grave. And this is actually backwards. This is actually what it looks like. And the shapes are based on that sort of elliptical form that happens when the sun shines through trees. Walt Whitman was a great poet, but he was a terrible architect. He designed his own. What do you call those little houses where people are buried? A tomb, not a tomb. Yeah, mausoleum. He designed his own mausoleum, and it's hideous. It is the most hideous thing you can ever imagine. But he was such an egomaniac, and it's in Camden Cemetery, which is a little dicey. Anyway, I went there, and it's surrounded by trees. It's so beautiful in the light. And so these shapes are based on the light shining through the trees, where it sort of, through the leaves, it makes an aperture effect. This is a piece that I did at Walden Pond in Massachusetts, where Thoreau spent 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days. And it is, I used Monet reproductions and went around, walked around the, I had cut out all these reproductions of water images from a stack of Monet books. And then walked around Walden Pond and then marked at different times where the point was and what the color was of the pond from different points in a view around the pond, and so they match against the Monet reproductions, and the whole shape is based on that's roughly the shape of Walden Pond. This is a piece I did in 2007. Based on, the sort of start-off point was the John Ford movie, The Searchers. It's a real, this is a real sort of Western landscape as well. What I did is I went to, another sort of motel room piece. I went to Monument Valley, where all those great Western, many John Ford Westerns were filmed, including The Searchers, and recorded the light at sunset in my motel room, both the color and the intensity. And then when I got back to the studio, I took all the stills, or I took thousands of stills from The Searchers, measured the color and intensity of each one, and then wove them all together into this 9-channel video installation so that it perfectly recreated the changing light of the motel room wall. So it starts quite bright and yellow. It was really kind of impossible to photograph. And then it turns more blue. And then by the end, there's just, you can see all 9 screens are on. That's actually the very beginning with all these very bright scenes. And then by the end, it's just the center screen is on, and there's just a very little bit of light by the end of the 35 minutes of the piece. This is a piece I did at Mass MoCA in 2007, and it changes sunlight to candlelight. It's like the Paris, Texas piece, but it precisely sort of limits the white light of the sun and reduces it just to a flame. So it's the exact color of candlelight, but a lot brighter. These are some photographs I did that are, it's called, the title is AG, which is the chemical symbol for silver. And they're photographs of modern silver, and they're silver prints. So the idea is that the photograph depicts, is made out of the exact same material that it depicts, if that makes sense. And I realized when I was photographing them that it's basically impossible to take a bad photograph of the reflections of silver. They're just so... It's just so beautiful and so so sort of sexy. Here's an ink drawing that I did. I did a series of these that are based on a glacier in New Zealand. I was in New Zealand in 2008 for a couple months and went to one of these glaciers, which was a really incredible experience, and took photographs and then made these drawings using frozen ink. So I mixed ink in different colors and in different densities and got a freezer that I kept in the studio and all these ice trays and created ice of different colors. And then there's the photograph it's based on. And that is the sort of process. So I would either smash it up or use the ice cubes and melt them in certain ways and didn't let it sort of melt naturally. I put it on angle and would just pull the ice off when it got too much, and then it would dry, and then put another layer. So it's lots and lots and lots of layers of ice. And sometimes I'd smash it, sometimes I'd a crusher, and sometimes I'd use the cubes that would create more of a flow. So it'd sort of start with the cubes that would create a sort of ground, an even ground, and then build up with the smaller pieces that are crushed over time. And it was, obviously trying to use the process itself to make a picture. This is a piece I did in Norway that is a star map. So each of these globes, there are two atria. One has the 50 brightest stars in the northern hemisphere. The other has the 50 brightest stars in the southern hemisphere. The colors of the globes refers to the color of the star, the spectral emission of the star. Most stars are, the younger stars are blue, a sort of middle-aged star is white, and the old stars are red, red dwarfs, for example. And then they were all located in their position in the night sky from the northern or southern hemisphere, and the height was determined by the distance from Earth. So the closest star, which is Alpha Centauri, maybe, was above like 15 feet up, and then the farthest star, which I think is Deneb, which is 3,000 light years away, was way up near the top. And the whole thing is solar powered, so it's powered by our own star. Here's another solar powered project I did in St. Louis two or three years ago. I wanted to make, who doesn't want to make a picture of a sunset? So that's what I did. I went out there and did these watercolors of the sunset behind the museum in St. Louis, and just matched the color of the sunset. And then created a installation of a solar-powered ice cream machine. So this is the ice cream machine, soft-serve ice cream machine, that's in front of the museum. I'm having a little trouble with this thing. There you can see the solar panels up to the left there. So there was enough power from this thing to run the ice cream machine for about 3 hours in the afternoon, which just happened to coincide with when school got out across the street. There are some kids, people getting free ice cream. And those are the colors. So the colors of the ice cream was based on the initial watercolors that I did of the sunset. And so they would alternate colors throughout the day. And it was really nice because as one color went to another, it sort of mixed the same way watercolor. So you get that sort of twist between the two colors with the bleed between the two of them. And then there were also sprinkles that I didn't photograph. I sort of let people decide. I was really open-minded. This is a piece, another Emily Dickinson piece. This is a photograph of rain on the window of this is actually in her the dining room of her house in Amherst. And this is just one pane. There are 16 panes in the window, I think, altogether. So I photographed the rain on the window and then photoshopped the entire image out of it so that all that is left is the drops. So all you see is the sort of refraction of the landscape of her house in the drops. And then that was printed onto clear acetate, and it was shown in this window in Brisbane, Australia, of all places. So you see this very weird tropical landscape through this window that has these raindrops on it that are reflecting this wintry, gray landscape of New England. This is a piece I did on the High Line, a new elevated park in New York. It's called The River That Flows Both Ways. It had 700 panes of glass, each one based on a single moment in the Hudson River. I was floating on a tugboat, and I just wanted to float with the tide. The title comes from the Native American word for the Hudson, because it is its title all the way up to Albany. It was called The River That Flows Both Ways. And so I just wanted to record the same point, so we were just floating on the tugboat for almost 12 hours. There's one pane. It starts at the top left, goes all the way across, and ends in the bottom. There's the actual colors in the printout as a as an Illustrator file. And so it's based on just all these photographs of water. So the format that I used was I took one pixel from each of the photographs. And so from the first one, which was around 9:15 in the morning, I took the pixel from the top left corner. And then from the middle, which was about 2 in the afternoon, I took a pixel right from the center of the photograph. And from the last photograph, I took the pixel from the bottom right. So the pixel it represents both the narrative, it creates a sort of narrative of the flow of the water, but also creates a composite, because the image is, of course, usually brighter in the water at the top than at the bottom. So it took me a while to sort of figure out a system, but it's a way of sort of doing both things. Here's a piece I did in Venice last year that shifts the sunlight to moonlight. This is in the Arsenale. Oops. This is a big project that I'm involved in Baltimore. It's the design of the facade, 250,000 square feet of glass in this new hospital building, which is a sort of very strange project that I fell into sort of by accident, by a strange series of events. And it was really, really fun to work on. And I'm totally petrified about it because it's it can't be changed. It's not like other things, you know. It's like it is up there and you can't change it. So I like call the architects now and I say, remember that blue? I think it should be a little more purple. And they just laugh. But it's totally, I mean, it's something architects deal with all the time, but it's as an artist, you know, you're used to being up and then it comes down and you're sort of safe again. And this is just going to be up there. And it's really a design project more than an art project because it was so collaborative. We worked with designers and with the people at the hospital and with the architects. But the colors were sort of based on this wisteria painting by Monet. And so I was thinking because there are two. This is the children's tower and this is the adult's tower. And they wanted differentiation between the two of them, but they wanted a sort of consistency. So the way I thought of doing that, and also use the reflection, which changes and sort of unifies them, was to think about water. So that thinking about a pond and that the water would be the same for both the children's and the adult's tower, but the what was reflected in the water would be different. So that was the sort of angle that I used for creating this consistency and at the same time a difference. So there is a sort of differentiation between the two parts. It's really a sort of really exciting project to work on because everyone just wanted to do a good job. It was really fun to be part of that. This is a piece I did last year in New York. It's a recreation of the shadows in my studio at night of the street lights from outside and the passing cars. So there's three main lights, mercury vapor, a sodium, and I think a halogen that create these overlapping shadows of the window. And then when cars go by, there's this other shadow that happens. So this is actually what you saw. I mean, you could go into the room on the left, but on the right is you can see the lights that are used to create the shadows, and then the passing cars were recreated by using this model train with a bright LED flashlight velcroed on top of it. So that as the train came around here, this bright shadow would go like this and go up the wall like that, which is what happens in the studio when the cars go by. Here's another piece I did from last year, another part of my Emily Dickinson obsession. I was really interested in this year 1862 when she wrote 366 poems, sort of an amazing output. I mean, each of those poems almost all of them are amazing. And to think that when she was like at this really productive, I mean, it must have been a manic moment. She was writing a poem a day. So I took a color from each of these poems and made a candle based on that color. About a quarter of them, there are no color words or color descriptions, so those are just plain white paraffin. But all the others, I mixed I turned the studio into a candle factory for a few months. It was kind of fun. It's like craft time, and mix the colors to match the color from each of the 366 poems. Each of the candles is designed to burn 24 hours, so that it burns for a whole day. And so basically, it's a calendar of an entire year. And this is in November. There's a detail of them, and they burn pretty beautifully. Here's a piece I did in France in the spring. Is recreating a Jap. It was sort of this funny thing, like recreating a Japanese moon viewing pond inside in a museum. And I created this dock that was really sort of a bridge, but also a dock that goes over the artificial pond. So the pond goes all around the space. What's sort of amazing about this this museum is that they agreed to let me flood the main gallery space, fill this with water, and below this room is the museum storage. I mean, can you imagine? Can you imagine if you asked them to do this, that here? I don't think they'd say yes. So I said, are you sure? Is that okay? And the director said, oh yes, we'll just add another layer for safety. So there's one more layer of plastic that they added for safety. But it was a really, and then there's this, so there's this moon-like that I was using for a project that, a theater project that I was really excited about that they pulled the plug on, sadly, because they didn't have money. So I took that and used that as the sort of artificial moon. And as you move around in the room and on the dock, the reflections always changing. You can see it there. And it was really, really fun to design that, to design the bridge. This is not a great photograph of this piece. I became obsessed with making these lumps in the spring and spent a lot of time, too much time on it, actually. I had this experience where I was walking down the street in Brooklyn, and it must have been February, and I saw this lump. It snowed and it was melting, and there's all that dirty snow on the street. So I saw this lump of snow on the corner and didn't really think about it. And then I was, the light changed, so I had to wait. And I looked down and I realized it wasn't a lump of snow, it was a lump of concrete. I just thought it was the funniest thing in the world. And so I was determined to make these lumps that, if you look at them out of the corner of your eye, they look like lumps of snow. But if you look at them closely, they're lumps of concrete. So I really was able to do it. And it's one of those things that was no one else really liked, but I'm really happy with my lumps. Here are some photographs I did in the spring that are... I stole this idea from a... there was a scroll I saw at the Philadelphia Museum that is a poet describing cherry blossoms floating down a stream as being like clouds, which I thought was such a beautiful image. So it was this... it sort of went with the lumps as this sort of mistaken perception of sort of seeing something as something else and seeing something out of the corner of your eye. And so I took photographs of cherry blossoms out of focus, and they look like clouds. Here's a piece that's up. This cloud piece is sort of a bad photograph. I haven't gotten good photographs yet of this. This is a cloud piece on wheels that moves around. That's based on constables, on studies of clouds by constables. So you can see the detail there, all of these filters. So each of these is like a... each of these is like a cut across a constable painting of clouds, and then the whole thing comes together to form this big open form of a cloud that moves around. Here's a photograph I did this summer that I just printed now. It's called The Moment When Three Dimensions Become Two Dimensions, and I was just I was looking at this apple tree and just sort of watching for the moment when I could no longer see it as three dimensions, when it had become a pure silhouette. And just seemed like the right subject. I mean, that's what really photography should be about. Whoops. Here's a project I just finished that is a wallpaper project. And this is light on the east wall of Emily Dickinson's bedroom, and so it's the actual wallpaper of her bedroom, and it's the light over the course of about, moving across the wall over the course of about 5 hours from the window is on the south wall, and the light shines in. Actually, it's right, sort of right near the edge there, and it sort of changes. And so it's wallpaper. And this is something else that I just finished that is, it's a solar-powered lunar module. So it's got, you can see, it has solar panels. So during the day, it absorbs this, it behaves basically just like the moon. And it absorbs sunlight during the day and emits light, the precise color of moonlight at night. And the design, of course, is taken from the Apollo lunar modules. And that's the last image.
Will you explain that the wallpaper, the Emily Dickinson wallpaper, is in fact wallpaper? That's not a photograph of her wallpaper.
Oh, yeah. So this is, yeah, it is, yeah. So it's wallpaper. So this is, yeah. Yeah, see, that's why I'm not explaining it so well.
You did everything except that.
So this is actually a design. This is an incredibly complex design that was done by the designer with me working with him. I mean, this is based, the actual wallpaper is the same. This is based on high resolution photographs of the wallpaper in her bedroom. And then there's an overlapping of all these layers that recreates the movement of the light from the window and through the day. So, that's it. You're welcome. Yeah?
On the fluorescent tubes, are those gels that you have right now?
Yeah, it's theater gels. And so what I do is I put a polycarbonate sleeve over the tube, and the gel goes on the polycarbonate sleeve, so it can slide. It can slide on and off, and it protects it a bit. Any other questions? Oh yeah, the color meter. It's what I use is a colorimeter. It's not like a spectrometer or anything that gives a wide range. It gives something called it gives two coordinates on what's called the CIE scale, which is a sort of standard for measuring the color of light. So color photographers use them sometimes, and lighting designers. So it matches the color of average light. It wouldn't break down the entire spectrum. You need a spectrometer to do that. Full breakdown. When I recreate the color of light, I'm recreating this sort of average color of the light. And because I use these fluorescents, there's no such thing as a full spectrum fluorescent. They're really high quality fluorescents, and so it's possible to match it more closely. And fluorescents are the best because they have the fewest dropout points of other things. Like with LEDs, you can't do it. Any other questions? Yeah.
Do you own your studio space in Brooklyn, or are you renting?
Well, that's an interesting question. I
just think it's gotten expensive. So I just
yeah, no, it is. It's gotten expensive. No, I own. Well, what happened was the building where my studio's been since '94 went up for sale in 2004. The artists all got together and bought the building. In order to do it, I had to move in, even though it wasn't legal to live there, but that was the only way I could afford to do it. So I moved in and divided my space. I took a bigger space, divided it, half living, half work. I now have more studio space because I've become more of a space hog, and so I now have, my studio space is across the hall, and I rent that from a friend. And so I own, and the old studio space has been more of it's being used for living space and is also storage space. So I own my, so I technically don't own my studio space. I own my storage space, and I own my wood shop space, and the sort of spray booth space. And someday I'll be able to move away from where I work.
Could you just add This might be an impossible question, but if you started your talk about that you got out of grad school and had to decide if you were, in fact, going to still be an artist, and had those kind of big questions, and what made you decide to go ahead and be an artist?
I don't know. I mean, I think probably about once a year I still have that sort of crisis. I think it's sort of important to have that kind of crisis. Like, what's the point of this? Why am I doing it? And is it really sort of meaningful? And it's funny, like today, like walking over to the Kimball, you know, I'll see like a painting, like there's that fantastic Goya painting of the bullfighter. I mean, it's just so incredible. And then I was like thinking about my lecture, and I thought, oh, what is the point? You know, what is the point? So it's usually things like that I see, and like sometimes it's like seeing, like if I see a living artist whose work I think is really amazing. Like I remember when I saw Richter's October 17th, 1977, or whatever, the Bader-Meinhof series. I just thought it was so fantastic. When I saw that for the first time, I thought it was just so great. And I thought, you know, what's the point of going on? And then I mean, it's easier with someone like that. You say, you know, I can do it. I can do it as well as, you know, I can, you know, do it better than old Gerhardt. But you see something like a Goya, and you think, really, what is the point? And so I think those sort of crises come less often, and I don't know what made me just sort of decide to do it. I just started working, you know, I didn't have a studio in the beginning and just was working on the kitchen table and just sort of working on drawings. And also my friends were all there, my friends were all doing it. So I think I think if I hadn't had that community of people, if I was on my own, I wouldn't have, because it's not, I mean, it's hard. I mean, And it's a struggle. And there was something I read. There was this, I wrote this down because I was thinking about, there was this thing in the paper today about Saul Bellow, where he described his experience as a writer as 169 brands of humiliation. And that's, you know, it's like, that's what being an artist is too. It's like, it never ends. So, but I think it's important to sort of question it. And I used to be much more, like critical of people who stopped making art, and now I'd say I'm more envious of them. I mean, because it becomes pathological at some point, and it's not totally healthy. Okay. Yeah.
Would you mind elaborating a little bit more on how you identify with not only literary figures or places that are prominent in literature, but also history through light and through the space that you measure?
I mean, I'm not sure it's identifying with these figures. I think it's more like finding a sort of armature on which I can do a sort of artistic exploration or something. Like, I feel like to do it about myself is not that interesting, but to do it about these sort of places, like to create a sort of somewhat loaded sort of moment. So, for example, to take the light, if you're going to recreate the light of a place, it has to be sort of meaningful somehow, and it has to be rich, and it has to also, I think, be somewhat ambiguous, because I'm not interested. I mean, I think it goes back to the whole sort of Beckett thing, where I'm not interested in this really strict communication of something. I mean, obviously I'm interested in certain things and creating certain parameters, but I don't think that it's about in the sort of 19th century Tolstoyan idea of the artist having a feeling or an emotion, putting it perfectly into an artwork, and then the viewer unpacks that emotion precisely when they view the artwork. I don't think that that's what happens. So I'm interested in sort of creating something that is maybe rich and also slow. And so I found these certain places or experiences that are somewhat sort of loaded, but maybe also interesting and can make for something meditative. I mean, it's something I worry about is being sort of a crutch, you know, that, you know, I have to like travel or go to these places to make my work, and it's like, or be dependent on other stories that, you know, my own stories aren't enough. But then I think I don't know. I mean, it's. I don't have a really clear answer. But like, for example, the passing cloud thing. I really wanted to do something about a passing cloud, and then I thought, well, where does it make sense to do it? I think it comes down to this idea of this. It's almost formal in that there has to be this necessary relationship between form and content. And if you think about it in poetic terms, it's sort of what the poem is and what it says, and so the sort of relationship between the sound and the meaning. And so, if there's that necessary relationship between form and content, that's really what I'm after. So that. You know, that if I were to do this passing cloud piece, that it really has to be Emily Dickinson's backyard. It can't be anything else. And I'm not sure that that's actually the case. If that were the case, the piece would definitely be a success. If that's not the case, the piece is a failure. But I think it's about creating that sort of necessary relationship between, really between form and content, between what it is and what it says. So you say, oh. And I think one piece where I feel that I do think there is that necessary relationship was that Nabokov-Heisenberg thing. I mean, it took me a long time to sort of find the text that sort of made sense with that form of Nabokov's alphabet. So that's one case where I feel it worked. I think there are other cases where it really doesn't work or is sort of forced, and I'm not so proud of. Yeah?
Have you ever explored cymatics and, like, the theory behind that of, like, the sound creating sculpture, inanimate objects?
No.
And, I don't know, it just seems like you use light to recreate the experience. And so
it's like, called cymatics?
Yeah.
S-I-M-A-T-I-C-S?
C-Y.
C-Y.
Yeah.
C-Y.
It just...
Cymatics.
Yeah.
No, but I have explored a cyanometer, which is a device that was created in the 18th century for measuring the blueness of the sky, which is developed by this great Swiss mountain climber and scientist who was the first person to climb Mount Blanc because he wanted to know whether the color of the sky changed as you gain altitude. And in order to do it, he had to climb Mount Blanc. And he had to create a cyanometer. And it does, it changes. Yeah.
Your excitement over that fact seems to explain why you need a place that matches your idea.
any other questions?
That's fantastic.
All right, thank you very much for coming.